Welcome to the Midday for a Wednesday. I'm Norman Gilliland, once again here in our Buck studio where we have some live music on hand and a live musician, too. I've seen her perform a couple of times in the last couple of weeks. Isabella Wu, welcome to the Midday.
Hi, thanks for having me here today.
And let's see, so you, at the age of 15,
yes,
are attending what school?
Madison Memorial High School.
And you've been piano playing probably for, I'm going to guess, 11 years already?
Yes.
Did I guess right?
Yes.
Somehow I just thought so. And is that kind of the natural trajectory in your family?
Yes. All of my family are pianists, actually, of varying skill.
Yes. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Well, my siblings and I all play piano. My mom also plays piano. My dad used to play piano. He doesn't really play piano now. He used to play percussion as well. He doesn't really play any instruments now, but he likes to brag about his percussion times.
With so many pianists in the family, is it an issue to get access to the instrument?
Yes. Uh-huh. Very much so. Our planning times for practice times have to be very efficient, well planned.
Is the practice time allotted equally?
About. It depends. Yes.
Do you ever really sneak in there a little early?
Sometimes, yes.
Well, I can imagine it would get very interesting. Do you do duets in the family?
Yes. I sometimes play them with my sister. It gets very interesting, though, because she and I have different ideas.
Oh, that's pretty common, yes. I think. But you can work those out, right?
Usually.
Uh-huh. I'm sure you have some interesting moments.
Yes.
What sort of things would you play?
So we've played some of the, I think it was the St. Saens Carnival March, yes.
Oh, sure, yeah, yes. From the Carnival
with
of the
elephants.
Oh, yeah.
I remember that particularly.
Uh-huh. He has a wonderful polonaise that's rarely heard for some reason, but it's just a great piece for piano four hands. Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've heard of that one yet, so I'll have to check it out.
Might talk to your sister and see if you can work that one up.
Yes.
Well, you brought some Bach. I know that you want to start with Bach.
And, yes.
And, of course, the harpsichords of the world say you can't do justice to it on the piano, but there is something about Bach on the piano that just has this eternal quality.
Yes. So the piece I'll be playing today is the first movement of Bach's Partita No. 2. Bach wrote 6 total partitas. He actually liked to write pieces in groups of 6, as you probably know.
That's pretty common back then, yes.
6, you know, 6 sonatas, 6 Brandenburg concertos, etc. So this particular first movement is called Symphonia.
And was this written for the keyboard? Or is this because he wrote partitas for various instruments and they're so often transcribed?
It was for the keyboard, yes. And this first movement, Symphonia, is divided into 3 sections. The first section is in adagio and then goes on to a song like Andante and ends with the final concluding fugue.
Which is, I'm going to guess, the most demanding of the 3 movements?
They're actually... The sections are demanding in their own ways. For example, the second section, the Andante, is simple but a little bit hard to bring out this simplicity style.
Yes. That's often a challenge, isn't it, just to bring out simplicity?
Yes.
So each movement has its own hurdles. And this is the Sinfonia from the Partita No. 2.
Yes.
By Bach.
Thank you.
Sinfonia from the Partita, Keyboard Partita No. 2 by Bach, played in our Buck studio by my guest today, Isabella Wu. And a very precise touch is required in that last movement, though, to get the voices to sing those melody lines against each other.
Yes.
So kudos to you for bringing all that out.
Well, thank you.
Now, Beethoven described this sonata of his, which for whatever reason is his most famous.
Yes.
As a sonata like a fantasy. And it is
Yes.
kind of anomalous, isn't it?
Yes. This sonata is by far his most famous. It's actually popularized by not his last movement, which I'll play today, but by its first movement with its opening triplet passage. Very famous. You can look on YouTube and there are just reels of 1 hour, 2 hours of the same 4 minute movement over and over again. Beethoven was actually so irritated by its popularity, actually, that he is once said to have said to his pupil Czerny, "Everybody is always talking about that C-sharp minor sonata. Surely I have written better things than that." Yes, so this particularly third movement I'll be playing today is very virtuosic. It requires lots of technical skills with arpeggiated passages, and doesn't ever seem to stop running until then.
It's almost like a perpetual motion piece, isn't it?
Yes.
So this is the finale of the Moonlight Sonata.
Thank you.
Wonderful stuff. Isn't it fascinating how with a piece like that you can hear it differently every time?
Yes.
Do you hear things coming out today that you didn't hear coming out
before? Yes, so another reoccurring theme of this piece, other than the arpeggiated passages, is the Alberti bass passages with a countering melody in the opposing hand. That's another melody I try to bring out in this piece.
I'd say it was there. Back now in our Buck studio with pianist Isabella Wu. And in, just about 5 or 6 minutes, maybe, we'll have our quiz question for today, that very short question that I promised you. Among Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsodies, you know, there is a tradition among pieces in general for instruments to imitate other instruments?
Yes.
And you have that here.
Yes. So this next piece I'll be playing is Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody number 11. Liszt wrote a total 19 rhapsodies, and in this one, and a couple other of his rhapsodies, Liszt utilizes the sound of the Hungarian cimbalom, which is a sort of dulcimer instrument with metal strings, which are usually hit with metal sticks, to put it bluntly. So in this piece, the first section, it's divided into four sections, and the first section utilizes this cimbalom sound. The next passages, next sections, get faster and faster until the final section, the fourth final section, erupts into this very virtuosic, joyful, rather fast march, Hungarian march.
So, well, it's from a Hungarian-born composer, a good Hungarian-sounding piece. This is the Rhapsody number 11 by Liszt.
Thank you.
Showstoppers. The Hungarian Rhapsody number 11 by Liszt. What were the challenges in that for you, Isabella?
So this one, unlike other pieces, particularly in the first part, doesn't contain as many melodic phrases, you know, with the tremolos at the beginning and so many rests. It's kind of hard to learn to connect the whole piece together. And the varying sections also provide a little bit of a challenge, especially in the third section with the running passages, with, you know, just one note little passages. It's kind of hard to connect. And then, of course, the technical difficulties of the last section.
A page black with notes.
Yes.
Well, it was a spectacular performance. And we are going to have some more from Isabella in the balance of this hour of the midday. But of course, now at 12:33, it's time to repeat yesterday's 12:30 quiz question and take on today's. Back now to our Buck studio and my guest for this hour of the midday, Isabella Wu, who as a composer, we've heard from Bach already, and this composer was really instrumental, probably more than any other composer, in bringing Bach back to light. We forget that classical music as a concept, you know, of being old music, is relatively new. And Mendelssohn was one of the composers who said, well, let's play some of this old stuff instead of just new things every time. And he brought out, I think, was it the St. Matthew Passion of Bach? I think everybody said, why are you playing that?
And then Bach became more famous than he ever was in his lifetime.
Yeah, that's right. And people said, oh, we're on to something here. I mean, composers didn't know about him. Mozart, of course, said, well, I think I could learn some things from him. But he was considered almost a novelty as a concert music source. And Mendelssohn, well, he, like Liszt, but not nearly so flamboyantly, was a concertizer, was quite a pianist, wasn't he, Mendelssohn?
Yes.
And he wrote this presumably for one of his performances, one of his public performances, and it has this wonderful romantic name.
Yes, it's the Rondo Capriccioso, Opus 14. So the origins of this piece actually date back to 1824, quite a few years before it was published, when he, for unknown reasons, wrote an etude in E minor. And then several years later, at the beginning of his grand tour, he found the chance to revive this work when he met the talented pianist. I think it was the pianist Delphine von Scharoth. And the two made a musical exchange in which Mendelssohn added a very romantic andante to his original etude. He described the process of recomposing this piece and adding on the introduction as adding sauce and mushrooms. Yes. So so later in the late 1830s, the piece ended up becoming a virtuosic showpiece. that was very popular, especially among the young ladies of the 19th century.
Well, I can't underestimate the role that young ladies played in the 19th century, even if they weren't musicians. I mean, the Moonlight Sonata, of course, yes, dedicated to a young lady, because Beethoven had already dedicated some other piece to another young lady, and he needed something in handy, yes, that he could dedicate to the next one. And a Liszt and the young ladies, well, that's legend, of course.
Yes.
And Mendelssohn, no exception. Mendelssohn was one of the composers who may well have been in love with the great singer Jenny Lind, for example. So there was a lot going on. It wasn't just composing, yes, pieces, but there was some inspiration provided by a lot of those young ladies, whether they were performers or not. And I mentioned the romantic quality of the title. Of course, Capriccioso doesn't, yeah, get much more romantic than that. But, I mean, is there a structure even when he says this piece is capricious?
Yes. Yeah, so after the introduction, it goes into a rondo in scherzo style, which also gives the pianist to show some virtuosity. Actually, this piece is also known to sound more difficult than it actually is to play.
Now, how does that work?
Not quite sure. I think it's the octaves. There are several octave passages in this work, which, at least for me, octaves are not that terribly difficult to play, but it sounds flashy,
uh-huh,
because, you know, it's quick.
Uh-huh.
And then there are several running passages, which are also, I don't think, very difficult to play, but sound fascinating when played fast. So,
and with this rondo, then we'd expect what structure?
Yeah, so actually, the theme at the right after the introduction, it comes back after, it comes back and repeats itself, I think, a total of 3 times.
I guess that's what rondos,
yes,
do, isn't it? You hear that
round, yes,
theme recurring. And then we get capricious and yet structure underneath it all, knowing Mendelssohn. So here it is, the Rondo Capriccioso, Opus 14 by Mendelssohn.
Thank you.
Well, it certainly is dramatic. I can imagine how the crowds would have reacted to that.
Yes.
It's not one of those pieces you have to wonder, is it over? He tells you. And was that syncopation I was hearing toward the end there? Is there?
Yes. It's broken octaves.
Yeah, so. Which is also seems a little unusual.
Yes.
I mean, that's the stuff of ragtime if you just push it a little farther.
Yes.
Mendelssohn was quite a showman, apparently, as a pianist. Now, let's see now. So you have finished your sophomore year in high school?
I have finished my freshman year.
You finished your freshman year in high school. Okay. And so are you going to spend 3 more years at Madison Memorial? Is that your plan?
Yes, probably. I'll definitely be doing a lot of piano and music.
And so do you have performance opportunities at school?
Sometimes, occasionally. I'm currently in the school band, actually.
So. Oh, yes. As a pianist?
As a percussionist.
Yes. So that's where the paternal influence comes in.
Yes.
Well, piano, you know, is a percussion instrument.
Yes.
After all. And what kind of outside opportunities do you have to perform?
Well, one recent performance, actually, my most recent performance was at the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra's Concerts on the Square, in which I played the Rachmaninoff No. 1 piano concerto. That was quite a fun experience.
Playing outdoors?
Yes.
For 25,000 people?
Yes. It's a little different. You know, you have to adjust to the weather and the humidity levels and all the weird sound warpings that happen outside.
Yeah, you never know what you're going to get.
Yes.
As far as the palette of sound. And then you repeated that performance a few nights later at Portage, right?
Yes. Which was also another outside concert.
Yeah, each very different from the other one in terms of the environment.
Mm-hmm. I believe that one was in front of a small pond.
Yes, it was.
Audience on the other side.
Very close to a small pond, which makes it all the more interesting.
Perilous.
What's that?
Almost dangerous.
Yeah, well, you have to be very careful getting from one side of the stage to the other, I suppose.
Yes.
And what other performances do you have coming up then?
As of now, not many. I'll definitely be working on a lot of solo works. I'm looking to complete the Rachmaninoff concerto. I've only learned the first movement. This second movement is a very, very petite, very small delight to learn. And the third movement is another showpiece, I guess.
And what do you do with that without an orchestra? How do you learn it?
Well, without an orchestra, I mean, I go on YouTube, listen to the accompanying part.
And so, in terms of actually performing it, though, this is just something you would do in-house? Because until you do have an orchestra to work with, there are pieces missing, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yes. But I think it's a good experience to learn how to play with an accompanist first before learning to play with an orchestra. It's a little bit of a difference, you know.
So you play them as a two piano, piano four hands thing, or how do you practice that with an accompanist, a concerto?
Well, usually just another piano. I happen to have two pianos at my house. I actually have three, but the third one is an electronic keyboard.
And why is that?
Because with the practice schedules, it got a little bit messy. And although we have two pianos in our main floor, you can't really practice next to each other.
Bleeding over would be a little distracting.
We have occasionally tried it. It's usually for fun, not because we actually want to practice.
Uh-huh.
So we actually have a third keyboard downstairs.
This is one you can play with headset? Is that the idea? So that people can't hear you? And how do those electronic keyboards work for you? I mean, are they close enough to the traditional piano for you?
The one we have downstairs is not particularly good. I tried to make my other siblings practice on it, uh-huh, and they don't like it as well.
But in terms, at least, of the sort of the touch of the fingering and all that, you can work on that.
Yes, I can do
under
that
those circumstances.
Downstairs.
Now, tell us about a cadenza. We've mentioned that you played the Rachmaninoff First Piano Concerto with the chamber orchestra.
Yes, yeah, so cadenza is usually where the soloist plays and shows off their own skills. This cadenza is particularly long. I think it's over 3 minutes.
Is this written by Rachmaninoff?
Yes, it was written by Rachmaninoff. So Rachmaninoff was never actually satisfied with his work. So after he wrote this concerto, like many years later when he was finally in the States, he went back and edited this whole concerto. And where it was hard for him to edit the whole thing because of the structure, you know, it was already published outside and there wasn't much he could do to the actual piece. But the cadenza, where, you know, it's just a soloist, that's where he could really...
standalone part.
Yeah, that's where he could really mess with it. And he ended up with this gorgeous 3-minute cadenza.
And here it is. This is the end of the... it comes at the end of the first movement.
Yes. Also, I would like to dedicate this performance to my late music grandfather, Mr. Howard Karp, who unfortunately passed away a couple weeks ago.
Quite a wonderful part of the music establishment.
Yes. He was always very encouraging to me and supportive of me, and unfortunately, he never got to hear me play this. So here is my performance to Mr. Howard Karp.
Thank you.
And after that, you have another couple of movements of that concerto to play. So it's not as if you get to take the rest of the night off when you get through that. That was quite spectacular. Well, Isabella, it's been a real treat having you with us.
Thank you for having me here.
For the midday today. We'll look forward to you coming back when you're, say, a sophomore in high school. Have all that much more experience behind you. It'll be fun to see how you develop as a pianist.
Well, thank you.